Never think about it. They don't wonder, is alcohol going to be at the party?
Right.
Or do I need to bring my own? Do I need to hide some on the way in or hide some in the
right.
car? Do I need to leave early and go to the liquor store? Like, they're not thinking about it. They don't care if it's there. It never crosses their mind.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word. Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and if you head on over to AngelaPugh.com or KansasCityRecovery.com, those are just a couple of places to connect with today's guest, Angela Pugh. Both her and I set down booze the exact same year, 2006. She did it earlier than I did in January. I waited till December 15th of 2006 to set it down, but we're going to share some of those stories today and what we've both learned about our road to recovery. And she, as a sober coach and life coach and entrepreneur, has some amazing nuggets, and you know how much I love nuggets, to help all of us connect a little bit more to that piece of us that could finally set it down for good. Let's jump off into today's episode with Angela Pugh. Welcome to our podcast. How are you today?
I am fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure to meet you.
Well, you know me, I like to get right to it. Actually, you don't know me, but I like to get right to it. And I want to talk about recovery as you've come to understand it, because it's a little bit different from everybody. Let's talk about January 2006. Actually, let's not. Let's talk about what's happening December of 2005, the 30 days leading up to the mark. We're jumping in the deep end right away.
I'm all right with that. I love the deep end. So December was, I mean, listen, it was challenging for sure. The end of my drinking got very ugly very quickly. And, you know, you hear a lot of people say, especially now, I've been doing this work for so many years, working with people with addiction. And you hear people say all the time when they're in that spot that they're rationalizing why they aren't an alcoholic, or, you know, because they're questioning. You start questioning your drinking, and really you understand what's going on, but it's hard to get to the place of understanding you can't have any more. And I hear people say all the time, well, I've never had a DUI. I've never lost a job because of my drinking. You know, I'm successful. I'm married. I have the house. I have the kids. And people think that that makes them less of an alcoholic. But the truth is, I didn't have any issues with my drinking until the last year. I was a very high-functioning person also, and I had great jobs, and I made a lot of money, and I lived in beautiful places, and I had the $70,000 Lexus in the garage. You know, I mean, I was all of those things too. But my last year, for me, once I got in the legal system, I got my first DUI in April of 2005. And once I was in the legal system, it got really, really ugly because I couldn't get out. You know, I mean, all they really want you to do is not drink. And that was the one thing that I couldn't stop. So I really compounded my trouble dramatically in 2005, from one DUI to showing up to see my probation officer drunk twice. And every time one of these things would happen, I would have to go back in front of the judge, right? And I would get reprimanded, and they would add things to my probation. I ended up having to go to jail for a minute. And then January rolls around, and I crashed my car. And I crashed my car at 70 miles an hour on the freeway. I hit another car. And there were a few minutes after my accident that I really thought I had killed the person that I hit. And it changed my life. Literally in a split second, my entire life changed.
And just so everybody's clear, the people that were involved in the accident, is everybody okay?
Everybody was okay. I was the only one hurt.
Yeah, I can imagine an accident like that changes your life. Interestingly enough, we had another woman from Kansas City on the podcast, Brandy. She had a car accident that was so bad it required six people to get her out of her car and save her life. And what came out of our conversation was, hey, listen, not everybody's lucky enough to get into a car accident. Not everybody's lucky enough to have a big traumatic moment to wake them up. Some people sit in their shit their entire lives and they never get out of it. And this was a moment where you rose up. You knew it was like,
that's the straw that broke the camel's back. Okay. Like if you're a godly person, you're like, okay, God, gotcha. And I can imagine that in that moment, you had to find almost a new identity, huh?
100%. You know, there were two things that happened in the aftermath of my accident. One was standing there thinking, I have to call my mom and tell her I just killed somebody, right? And I have like one of the best moms on the planet who doesn't have any of my issues. She's like the most honest, incredible person who has always lived with so much integrity, you know, and I was the wild one. So I'm just thinking about how do you have that conversation, right? And I'm thinking like, I'm going to break my mother in one conversation, literally break her, you know? That was part of it. The other part of it was I had had a few different situations that I probably shouldn't have walked away from. And standing on the side of the freeway that night, I remember thinking like, gosh, there must be another plan for me because I'm trying my best to die on a daily basis, like praying to die on a daily basis. And I keep coming out of these situations okay, like there must be something else I'm supposed to do, right? Like this isn't my path. This isn't my final, because I always thought at some point I would go to sleep one night and I just wouldn't wake up. I didn't have future plans. I didn't think about when I hit 40 years old or 50 years old. I never thought about getting married or having kids because I didn't think I would be alive. And nor did I want to be alive. But in that moment, it's like, wow, okay. Like this isn't the end for me, right? I always thought my drinking would be the end. And all of a sudden I understood that it could have been just the beginning.
Interesting. Can I ask why you didn't want to be alive?
You know, I just, the last couple of years of my drinking had just gotten so dark, you know? I mean, I just was depressed. I was so depressed and I hated myself and I was lying and I was just doing more and more kind of despicable things and it was just gross. I hated who I was. And my life had changed significantly when I moved to Kansas City from Los Angeles. And it was really hard change for me to make. It was very difficult in a lot of ways. And I didn't handle it well. And, you know, I was dating probably one of the worst people I had ever dated who was really verbally abusive. And I was a bartender most of my adult life. And you know, most of my life, I didn't have to go to work until late. You know, a lot of my life, I didn't go to work till 11 p.m. When I got sober, the last couple of years I was drinking, I worked in a bar and I had to be there at 5. And I was having a hard time getting there by 5, right? And there were times I was calling, making up lies and excuses because I was staying up and drinking after I would get off work, right? 3 in the morning. And I would stay up and drink until 5 a.m. And then it was 6 a.m. And then it was 7 a.m. before I was even going to bed, wasted, you know? So it just was really dark. And I didn't see a future for myself. You know, imagine living in a space where you have no hope. Like I didn't think I had any kind of future. I had nothing to look forward to. You know, I thought I was such a disgrace to my family. I come from a family of really phenomenal people. And I was always kind of the odd man out in that way. You know, I was always the crazy one and had a little more flair than the rest. And that feels really bad too. You know, and as much as your family loves you, for me as an alcoholic, you know, I hated going to family dinners and things like that because I just felt like it amplified what a loser I was. You know, everybody else is doing well and has their lives together. And I have a whole bunch of brothers and a couple of them were pretty young back then, but you know, my older brother was like leading this great life, you know, continuing to be the perfect child and, you know, married and having kids and the job and the whole thing. And it's like, I sat there just a hot mess, you know? So all of that is just, I just didn't have any hope for any kind of a future. And it felt like torture every day having to face myself and just having to get through the day. It just felt like torture.
Sure. When I got sober, I had a really horrible incident the night before. Can you tell me about yours? And then I'll share a bit of my journey.
Well, first, my grand plan was to kill myself, you know, because I had so much legal trouble because it had only been 8 months since my first DUI. And like I said, I had already showed up drunk twice, you know, so it's like every couple of months I was in more trouble and I just couldn't see like how I was going to get through it. Right. And I was so humiliated and I'm like, oh, great. Now I get to tell my family this, you know what I mean? Like, here I am again, the shit show, you know, like it's just so, ugh, it's so gross. So that was my grand plan, but I think I fell asleep instead. So I didn't follow through on that.
I'm glad it worked out that way.
I'm glad it worked out. And you know, I didn't get my pain meds filled when I left the hospital before I went home as a punishment to myself.
Because fascinating.
I felt like for the first time I was as ugly on the outside as I was on the inside. And I wanted to punish myself and be in pain because I felt like I deserved that. And looking back now, it's another one of those really beautiful kind of higher power moments to me, because if I would have gotten pain meds in that moment, I probably would have ended up addicted to those, you know? So I'm so grateful that I didn't get them. But I laid in my house and I detoxed for about 3 days, and I had plans with my friends. We had bought tickets to a concert like months before all of this happened. So my friends are calling me and they're like, just come out, dude. You can't stay locked up forever. Like, we don't care what you look like. Cause I didn't have a broken nose where like you get two black eyes. My nose was broken at the base of my nose. So the whole lower half of my face was swollen. And then the two cracks in my head. So that was swollen too. They were like, we don't care what you look like, but you have to get out of the house. Like, you can't just stay in there forever. You know, we've had these tickets forever. Just come out. And so I decided to go. Now, I assumed that everybody would understand I wasn't drinking because I just had my accident, right? But they assumed, because I was the party animal, they assumed that I would be drinking. So I ended up in this situation. It was a Friday night, and I ended up in the situation where my buddy looked at me. I had the strength one time to say, I'm not drinking. And he looked at me and he's like, listen, I know you're going to drink if I get you something, so you may as well just get what you want. And I just, in my head, in that moment, it was probably 2 seconds, but I thought of every single angle. I'm like, I don't have a car. I'm an hour from home. I have nobody that will come pick me up. I don't have $100 for a cab ride, right? We didn't have Uber back then. And I don't have $100 for a cab ride. Like, I felt trapped. I was like, am I not going to drink and everybody's going to be mad at me all night and it's going to be miserable? Like, how am I going to get through this? I can't leave. And so I made the decision to drink that one last night. And I knew it was the last night. I wanted no part of it. I just wasn't strong enough at that time to figure out my way out of it, you know? So I drank, of course, like a crazy person. And I woke up that next morning, Saturday morning, and the first thought that went through my head was, thank God that's over. And I was just thinking about my drinking life. Like, I knew it was done. I knew I wouldn't drink again. I didn't want to drink again. And I also knew that I would never be without my own car. I would never be dependent on other people and never assume that people are going to understand I'm not drinking. Like, I have to speak up for myself. I have to draw those boundaries and protect myself because nobody else is going to do it.
Yeah. So it's December 14th for me. And I live in Denver at the time. It's a Christmas party for the radio station that I work for. I go to the party. I have an obscene amount of wine and scotch, which was my thing. I believe in your inaugural episode, you talk about how you were an expensive drunk. I was an expensive drunk too. I appreciated very good booze. I appreciated good scotch, appreciated good wine. And I made enough money where I didn't spare any expense. And so, similar to what I think I heard in one of your podcasts, I went for it that night. And what you need to know is that I just moved to Denver 6 months earlier than that. And literally a couple of weeks after we moved to Denver, my wife and I have our first child. So I've got a 6-month-old baby at home. And I go to this party. We tear it up. It's 10 o'clock. The party's over. But I am nowhere close to being done. I am ready to rip it up. So I decide that I'm going to walk home because there's this bar that's next to our house. And I'm going to walk home. It's snowing. And I live a few miles from where this is. I have my suit on with my dress shoes and my coat, and I literally walk in the snowstorm 3 miles to this bar. It's closed. And so I walk home, and I'm so drunk, I knock on my door, My wife opens the door. She's crying. The baby is crying. They haven't slept all night because he's, you know, got some acid reflux and it's a whole thing that we're dealing with. I am zero help to my wife and kids in that moment. I go to bed, I pass out, I wake up the next morning and I write them a letter that says, I will never drink alcohol another day in my life. And similar to what you just shared with me, that was it for me. It was very clear to me that I was never going to thirst for alcohol again in my life, that I must turn that knob off. And that's what is so hard for folks on the outside to understand. It's like, as much as you want somebody to stop drinking, until they want to stop drinking, it's just not going to happen unless there's some huge, huge event that, you know, brings them to a crossroads. So I don't know how much of that story resonates with you, but here it is all these years later and, you know, I haven't had a drink. There you go.
And you know that that is not a very common story. And that's something I learned. So I started going to 12-step meetings. I think I detoxed for about a week, right, before I could actually get up and like go anywhere and do anything. And I started going to AA very quickly. And back then too, you know, there weren't options. Like now there are so many options. There's so many different ways you can do it. And there are so many different programs. But back then we didn't have all that stuff. You know, it was right. Go to AA or don't, you know. And I knew I had to be committed to it. And part of going to meetings for me was to really be able to gauge my level of commitment. I needed to physically do something to know that I was remaining committed to it. Because I wasn't so arrogant that I thought I had some magic that I would never drink again, right? And once I was sitting in 12-step meetings, every day people are coming in relapsing every day. And I'm a bartender and I'm like, what the hell is going on, people? Why aren't they staying sober? Like I'm surrounded by booze every day and I'm not drinking. And it was really hard for me to understand. I mean, now, you know, 100 years later, I get it. There are so many different things at play, but that's just not a common story. To quit drinking and really be done is not a common story. Most people relapse many, many, many times before they finally get it. You know, people don't understand when you want to make a huge change in your life, you have to change, right? You have to do things differently. So you can't just, and I see this a lot too, right? People want to put down the drink and they just want to go on living their exact same life. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, it doesn't actually work that way, right? It's just like, if I want to lose 10 pounds, I can't go to the drive-thru every day, right? You have to make some lifestyle changes, and getting sober is the same way. So I knew because I wasn't taking any action to have a different life, I knew I was headed right back to my drinking life.
Okay, so then let's start here. Somebody has that thought that, you know, they're like, you know what? Maybe I, like they're starting to get aware. Maybe I'm starting to become kind of an alcoholic. This is turning into a thing. Like I just got my first DUI. That's, you know, okay, so maybe we talk to that person first.
Yeah, if they're kind of contemplating, I think most of the time people are more clear in their minds than they are in their words. And oftentimes people will get on the phone with me. Usually when somebody gets on like a consultation call or something with me, they want to do my coaching program or something. We always minimize our drinks, right? But the thing is, you know in your head what the truth is. It doesn't matter how much you minimize it to me. And what I always say to people too is like, listen, you don't end up on the phone with me because you're unsure if you have a problem or not. It's the same thing we used to always say in AA. You don't end up in an AA meeting because you're wondering if you have a drinking problem, right? Because it's the last house on the block. Nobody wants to go there. So if you actually get to a spot that you're finding a meeting, driving there, and going through all the terror of walking in for the first time, if you're going through all of that, you know the score, right? Like you're in a spot that you probably need to quit. But it's really observing things. You know, I don't love all the things that are on the internet. You know, you Google, am I an alcoholic? I don't love all the things that come up, you know, drinking alone, blacking out, about drinking in the morning, because a lot of those things weren't a part of my story. And that didn't make me less of an alcoholic, I promise you. You know, just because I wasn't blacking out every day did not make me less of a drunk. I was absolutely a drunk. So I like to remove that stuff from it, because those are all the ways people will minimize it. Well, I don't drink alone, you know, and I've never drank in the morning and I've never lost a job. And it's like, those aren't the important details. Rock bottom is mental and emotional. Rock bottom isn't events, right? We always want to attach it to, for me, my car accident. Absolutely, that was a rock bottom moment. But I was at such a rock bottom emotionally. That's the part that really gets you to take action. And that's the only part that will get you to be committed on a long-term basis, because you have to feel better. So it's about how you feel. It's about how do you feel about your drinking? Are you feeling like crap about it? Are you setting rules around your drinking and breaking them, right? Oh, I'm only going to drink on Saturdays, or I only drink after the kids go to bed. I never have more than one glass of wine while I make dinner. You know, there's all these rules. For me, it was, I'm only going to have one drink an hour. And I remember a girlfriend of mine said to me once, she's like, I think maybe you should only drink wine. And I said, well, I don't think it's what I drink. I think it's that I drink 100 of them. I think that's the problem. You know, but there's all these rules that we want to put on it. Well, I'm only going to spend this much money, or, you know, I'm only going to drink wine. I'm only going to drink beer, no hard alcohol. Right, and if you're putting those rules around it, listen to me, non-addicted people do not put rules on their drinking, because don't think about alcohol enough to care. When alcohol is occupying that much of your brain space, that is an abnormal relationship with alcohol. That's the important stuff. It doesn't matter if you're blacking out or drinking alone. Nobody cares. It's how you feel about what you're doing and how much of your time and energy it's taking.
That's so wonderfully articulated, Angela. Gosh, you're special. I just love everything that she just said, because that is the differentiating factor. You're right. People who aren't alcoholics, they do not think about it.
They never think about it. They don't wonder, is alcohol going to be at the party?
Right.
Or do I need to bring my own? Do I need to hide some on the way in, or hide some in the car? Do I need to leave early and go to the liquor store? Like, they're not thinking about it. They don't care if it's there. It never crosses their mind.
As you're coaching people maybe now who are not at the beginning of the awareness, but they're toward the end, it's becoming an issue, right? Like my buddy, Dr. Dave, says a disorder is something that starts to affect your life. So now the alcohol's become the disorder for them. It's impacting life, family, relationships. I know you do interventions. So maybe this is a good place to talk about that. What happens at some of your interventions?
So an intervention really is just a conversation where everybody involved comes together and is on the same page, right? Everybody has the same information. And really what we're doing is putting a plan together so the person with addiction can just say, okay, yes, I'll go. I don't want you to have to think about anything, make decisions, make phone calls, right? We get all of that done in advance. But, you know, something we do as addicts too is what's called triangulation, right? Where you kind of give different information to each person. So, you know, your spouse has some parts of the story, your parents have some parts of the story, your siblings have different parts of the story. And in the intervention, we all come together and everybody's got all the parts of the story, you know? So there's no BSing everybody, and all that manipulation is kind of taken out of the picture. So it's just a conversation to get real about what's happening and to offer a solution, you know? And it's not, it is a lot like the television show in process, but I will say, because I think this scares people a lot about doing an intervention, interventions usually are not very dramatic, honestly. I mean, it's a pretty, and obviously it depends on the interventionist too. I do a lot of coaching with the family going into those conversations, because it is imperative that the energy of that room stay calm and loving and kind. We're not backing anybody into a corner. We're not ganging up on anybody. It's just really important that we approach it a specific way. So I'm pretty particular about who is a part of the conversation. I don't always let everybody be in that room. And there are other ways that we can include them, because I definitely, if you've been hurt by the addiction, I want you to be heard in that conversation, but it's just not the right spot for everybody to be directly involved. So yeah, we just come together and basically we've put together a team to save your life, hopefully. And we just want you to join the team. That's really all it is.
Yeah, and don't you find, I would guess that most interventions, like you said, aren't these big, angry, screaming sessions. I would imagine most people sit in that chair, and when it's come to that point, they're like, okay.
So many people are relieved. So many people.
Right.
Because when you're living in that space, and this is why I say to families too, when you're living in that space as the addict alcoholic, you cannot figure out how to get out of there. You know, I always joke and I say, I couldn't even figure out how to start stopping. I could not figure out the first step to take because it felt so overwhelming and so big. And it was every aspect of my life was just a mess. You know, so many, many people are just relieved. They're like, yeah, thank God. I definitely need help. Right. And people get mad. Of course, there's a couple of spots in the intervention. Everybody gets mad about the same stuff. You know, of course, when it first starts and they realize it's an intervention, they'll get a little mad about that. And everybody's talking behind their back. Mm. And then, you know, we can talk through that stuff pretty easily. And then they typically will get angry when they realize that, like, we're leaving that day when that part of the conversation comes up.
Okay. So this is happening now.
Yeah. Not only are we glad you said you're going to treatment, but we're leaving like right now. So that can be a tricky little spot, but it's important. You know, every piece of an intervention is strategy, every single piece of it. And if done well, intervention can be incredibly successful.
Well, I like that idea that you go right away because it's an urgent matter. We're not here because this is something we can start next Sunday. Like we're here because it's become a big enough issue. I will tell you this, and I'd love to spend a couple of minutes as we wind down, cycling through what is going to happen when you set down alcohol, if that's a choice that you can make for your life, because you're going to go through a lot of different feelings afterwards. And one of the things that you're going to think a lot about, if you're any kind of human being, is what you did to people when you were drunk, how you treated people when you were drunk, how you treated relationships when you were drunk, how you put alcohol ahead of almost everything. Mm-hmm. And you're going to need to come to a crossroads about those moments. And it's important that you get to that crossroads and you really hit it head on and you feel those things. How much of what you talk to people about is this idea behind, hey, why don't we make some amends? Why don't we say sorry to the people that we might need to say we're sorry to?
Well, I definitely work with people on, I wouldn't say an amends process, but taking personal responsibility, because that's really my favorite thing that I've learned as a result of my own recovery is taking responsibility for my own BS. You know, I love that. I love, because again, I'm a control freak, right? So when I can understand how my decision-making was off, because we tend to make decisions for instant gratification. If you always make your choices in your life based on instant gratification, you're going to make all kinds of shitty choices. And that gives me more control, right? When I can own my part of it and modify my behavior, it gives me more control in my life.
Twist.
Which makes you feel better, right? I mean, it's because you have to start to get a grasp on things because you feel so out of control with everything. I mean, we're crazy. And like AA says, in the first step, my life had become unmanageable. I mean, my life was so far beyond unmanageable. And I thought I was controlling all of it, you know, but it just was very empowering for me to really step into that personal responsibility and understand that all of my drama was self-created and that I could learn to make my choices for different reasons. And it's okay to make a mess in your life. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to mistreat people. Most of the time we don't do that intentionally. But the key is if you make a mess, you have to go back and clean it up. right? And that's personal responsibility. That's going back and going, hey, listen, I'm really sorry for how I said that. I was a jerk. I didn't want that to go that way. I really didn't want to be in a fight, whatever the thing is. I can almost always make amends for my delivery because I can be abrupt, let's say.
So, you know, when I'm talking to people, Angela, I say, if you're feeling it, isn't there a chance they're feeling it too? And so many people are ready to just let the air out of the tires. Like the moment you say, hey, my bad. Yeah, buddy, I know. You've both been carrying this thing that you can set down and you don't have to carry it any longer. There's so much freedom on the other side of those conversations. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. And to me, it's also a great act of service because there aren't enough people going back and taking responsibility for their missteps. That's not something we get a lot. So if I can be a person that can go back and say, hey, you know what? I'm really sorry. I've been absent. I haven't reached out, or whatever the thing is. If I can go back, how that makes the other person feel, how valued they feel, dude, that's a game changer. That's what I'd live for, you know?
Amen. Do you miss it? If so, what parts of it do you miss?
I have never missed a moment of it. But I think because when I got sober, I had hope, right? When I was drinking, I had no hope. I had no hope of a future. I had no hope of a life. I had no hope of being a good person. And then all of a sudden, I got this opportunity to be whoever I wanted to be. And I had some power in that, in building myself to be the person I wanted to be. And it has been the most phenomenal thing that has ever happened to me. Being an alcoholic is the best thing that ever happened to me, for sure. Wow. But I don't miss a moment of my drinking life. Not a second of it. It was such a waste. And I had a lot of fun for a lot of years, but it was a very different kind of fun, right? And it's probably an aging thing too. As you get a little bit older, your priorities and your values shift a little bit. And, you know, having the cutest outfit and the best heels isn't my sole focus anymore as it was in my 20s and working in the coolest place so I could be the coolest. You know, I mean, all those things definitely shift. But man, what a joy. I mean, I get to do whatever I want. I get to be whoever I want. There's absolutely nothing on the planet I can't do, except maybe dunk a basketball. That would be challenging. But I could do it with a trampoline.
What an incredible story from AngelaPugh.com. That's where you can visit and find her online. We will see you next week right here on Learn From People Who Lived It.
We have three goals with Learn From People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.